Okay, welcome back to the lecture. There was a week break now, and what we did last week was basically the following. First, we looked at real-world authenticated key exchange construction. So authenticated key exchange constructions. And key exchange constructions in general. So there were a couple of things that are implemented in the real world, like TLS or the noise protocol framework that, in contrast to TLS, does not have all the flexible modularity. So TLS is meant for you have a huge internet, nobody knows what the other's computers are configured for. And so TLS idea is that whenever one user wants to talk to another one, they will just tell the other one, okay, I'm configured that way. Is there any compatible way that you can communicate with me? And then based on that negotiation, there is some way of confidential and authenticated key exchange. In contrast to that, we have the noise protocol framework that is meant for deployment settings in which all of the users are configured the same way. One of the applications or one of the use cases of the noise framework is that in WhatsApp, for example, whenever the client, the app on the phone is communicating with the server, they will, instead of using TLS, they will use the noise protocol or one of the patterns from the noise protocol framework. And the reason is that, of course, WhatsApp can control all of its apps the same way. And so they can configure what they are speaking. And so basically, all of them are speaking the same as the server. Chrome is sometimes making similar use of that for communication between Chrome and Google, or Chrome and Cloudflare. And so similarly, very quick changes can be implemented for those type of communications, also for Firefox and Cloudflare. But of course, the internet is larger than just Cloudflare, Chrome, Firefox, and Google. And so the internet needs to be capable of being adjustable. And so for that reason, we need protocols like TLS. We finally talked about the X3DH protocol, and the X3DH protocol is the protocol that is used for establishing messaging sessions in Signal and in WhatsApp and so on. And this brings us to the second part of last lecture, in which we talked about the idea of ratcheted key exchange. For short, RKE. So today we will dive deeper into this world of ratcheted key exchange and understand again what the role of that is. So we again will motivate a little bit of what ratcheted key exchange is. And we will have the first formal security definition for it. Okay, let's directly jump into the setting. We will repeat a couple of things on a slightly different or with a slightly different perspective than what we did last week. But we basically are talking about ratcheted key exchange. And this will be the topic for this week and for next, like in 2 weeks, since next week will not be a real lecture. So ratcheted key exchange has the following idea. So we have Alice and we have Bob. Both of them want to communicate, and the idea is that they want to communicate for a long time. So they want to have a channel that lasts for a long time, through which Alice and Bob can continuously send messages. Okay. So this is the most important aspect for why we are having this type of primitive, because we have long-term. Communication. Okay, so in order to establish such a channel, such a long-term channel, the first thing that we use is a so-called initial key exchange. And we talked about such an initial key exchange last week already. I said that a couple of seconds ago. One example is the X3DH protocol. And we will not further look at that. We will just use the key that is established, put it into our session setting here, and after that, focus on the ratcheted key exchange part. So this is the first thing that happens. This will output a key on both ends. And this key can then be used. Then there is some ratcheted key exchange. As well as a secure channel. And so the message that Alice is sending is sent through that secure channel. Okay, so part two is ratcheted key exchange, and part three is a secure channel. One of the examples of a ratcheted key exchange is the double ratchet that we will probably talk about in 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, due to the break in 3 or 4 weeks. And those type of protocols, like the double ratchet, is the focus of the remainings or the of the next of this week, the next 2 weeks, basically. An example of a secure channel is more or less based on authenticated encryption with associated data. Okay, so what I've been saying is that the ratcheted key exchange protocol is continuously updating key material. And then, whenever there is a new key, then a new channel is used to actually encrypt messages and decrypt messages. And so the basic idea of why we are doing these key updates is the following. It can always happen that key material is corrupted. So this can happen on Alice's side, but it could also happen on Bob's side, that at some point, the attacker has access to one of the two users' phones. And that basically means that at that point in time, we cannot hope for any security guarantees. But nevertheless, what we still want to have is that until that moment, we have security, and also until that moment before that. So So we want to have security, we want to have security after that, and we want to have security whenever possible. So this is the idea of what Ratcheted Key Exchange is giving us. And we've heard of forward security previously already. Forward security is the idea that whenever something was corrupted, whenever something is corrupted in the future, we want still that things are secure. So we see here the first corruption happens at some point on Alice's side. And for everything that happens before that, we want to have security. Then we want also after that, that Alice can recover from such a corruption. And so this means that we want to have post-compromise security. So whenever a compromise happened, we want to have security in the future. Again, on that side here, as soon as Bob is corrupted, we want again that security before that still is maintained. And that means we want to have forward security. And so as soon as Bob is capable of doing so, we want that after the corruption, we again have security, which is post-compromise security again. So that being said, a little bit more formal or more clearer. So first of all, what the attacker is doing is, first of all, of course, seeing the corruptions, but also seeing all the traffic that is sent over the wire. So the attacker sees the traffic and the attacker sees information about the corruptions. Okay, so forward security. Means that past communication should stay secure. Even if keys are corrupted in the future. And post-compromise security means somewhat the opposite, not really the opposite of that, but somewhat the complementary security guarantee that future communication should become secure or, put differently, recover even after previous corruptions. Now there is oftentimes the argument that whenever things are corrupted, why can we hope for any security after that anymore? Why wouldn't the attacker stay there permanently? And the main argument is that not all the attacks that we are considering are really fully malicious attackers. Of course, if there is a virus on my phone and that virus is continuously sending the messages that I'm communicating via Signal and WhatsApp to the attacker, then I can't hope for security. But there are situations in which my secrets are leaked because, I don't know, there was a bug in the app. And so the app was just logging key material for 3 weeks. And after those 3 weeks are over, then the keys are never leaked again. Or I don't know, maybe I don't know. The randomness generation was not super good at some point, so things are not optimal. But at some point, there is an update of the app. Or maybe the access that the attacker had on my secrets were due to just scanning the files on my mobile phone. And if this is just such a passive attack where the attacker just sees information but will not plant a virus, then it makes sense to still try to achieve the best thing that we can hope for. Of course, in situations in which we can't hope for anything, it's not necessary to implement all these things. But if it is cheap, it makes sense to just implement those things and we are happy. Okay, so this is the high-level goal that we want to achieve, the high-level primitive that we want to build. Now the question is, how does that thing look more closely? And we want to distinguish between three different cases. The first one is so-called bidirectional ratcheted key exchange. So this is basically two parties both communicating and both communicating with the same privileges whenever they want to. And the rough syntax that we need for this is that we have Alice and Bob. They both initialize their session state with a joint algorithm that gives Alice a state of Alice and Bob a state of Bob. And then Alice and Bob will use that state. And I've been saying this last week already, or 2 weeks ago already, that the init algorithm is in principle a probabilistic algorithm, but it could just also be a deterministic algorithm that just is taking the key of the initial key exchange as the randomness. And so in our heads, we can just think of first the initial key exchange being run between Alice and Bob with public key material. Then Alice and Bob have a symmetric key. Then they will run the init algorithm with which they obtain both the sender state and the receiver state, or Alice's state and Bob's state. And then Alice will remove or just ignore the state of Bob. And Bob will remove and ignore the state of Alice, and then they will just use their individual state for communication. Okay. Now, whenever Alice wants to send something, she's using her send algorithm. And that send algorithm takes as input the sender state. It outputs the first key that Alice is computing. And it outputs also a ciphertext that is sent to Bob. Now, whenever Bob is receiving things, he's using his receive algorithm that takes as input Bob's state, the ciphertext that has just been received, and it outputs the key K1. Of course, Alice and Bob can both send. This will result in K2. And maybe also Bob concurrently or at the same time is sending, which results in K3. And now the outputs of that may cross the wire such that C2 and C3 are received at different points in time or sent at different points in time. Let's just do it like that. Didn't make sense. C3. And now, when Alice wants to receive something, she is again just taking the state that was output by the send algorithm, and she will compute the third key. And when Bob receives, again, he's taking the state that was output by the send algorithm, by his send algorithm, and he will compute K2. And this can continue forever. So this is full bidirectional communication. The basic algorithms that I've just been talking about is the init algorithm that probabilistically outputs the state of Alice and the state of Bob, which is basically the same as if the init algorithm takes as input a key that could be taken from the initial key exchange. And then, for example, Alice can just compute her state and will ignore the second output. And the basic idea for this is that we have an initial key exchange. And this will output a key on both sides. And from this, Alice will derive her state. And from this, Bob will derive his state, in the sense that the two keys are compatible. So this is basically an abstraction for the following. Okay, then we have a send algorithm that is used by both users whenever they want to. The send algorithm takes as input the state, and it outputs a key and a ciphertext, and the receive algorithm takes a state and a ciphertext and outputs a key. The send algorithm is probabilistic, the receive algorithm is deterministic. Okay, so this is the most complicated version of ratcheted key exchange that we could look at. And in order to make things more simple and more comprehensible, what we typically do is we simplify things. And the first way to simplify things is to look at something that we call sesquidirectional, RKE. And sesqui in Latin means 1.5. And the basic idea here is that Alice maintains her full role of sending things, and Bob has somewhat a limited form of sending. And we will now understand what that limited form means. So again, we have Alice and Bob. We have, again, the init algorithm. The init algorithm will give Alice a state and Bob a state. And now what happens next is that we basically have a similar form of communication, but the communication will be slightly restricted. So just as before, whenever Alice is sending something, she will output a key on the sender on her side, and she may compute a ciphertext that is sent to Bob, who can use his receive algorithm to output the same key. Now again, I said that Alice and Bob can both send. So whenever Alice sends, she will still compute a key. The change will just occur now when Bob sends. So still, Alice can send. She will send a ciphertext, which will be processed by Bob whenever he uses his state. and this will compute a K2. But interestingly now, whenever Bob is sending something, his algorithm is only outputting a ciphertext, C3. This send algorithm on Bob's side will not produce any key. And as before, those things can continue forever. So now what we have is we have the same init algorithm. The only difference is now that we have two different send algorithms and two different receive algorithms. The send algorithm on Alice's state will still output probabilistically a key and a ciphertext. But the send algorithm, when being used with Bob's state, will probabilistically only output a ciphertext. Whenever the receiver is using Alice's state with a ciphertext, this will only update Alice's state. But whenever Bob is using his state with a ciphertext, he will both update his state. Oh, excuse me. I've been missing something up over there. Sorry. So of course this will update the state. It will output a key and will output a ciphertext, but this was hopefully clear roughly, but yeah. So of course, going back to the previous bidirectional case, whenever Alice is sending something in the bidirectional case, she will use her state, she will update her state, she will compute a key and a ciphertext, and the ciphertext is given to the receive algorithm on the other side, which takes a state, ciphertext, updates the state, and outputs a key. Okay, so there is functionality, which is establishing keys. Those should be secure, but there is also a security ingredient in updating the state, for the reasons that we want to have forward security and post-compromise security. Okay, yeah. Okay, this is important to mention. Now, back to the situation that the ratcheted key exchange is limited to a SESQ directional communication setup, where Alice, whenever she is sending, will not only output key and ciphertext, but she will also update her own state. And of course, also, whenever Bob is sending something, he is updating his own state and outputting a ciphertext. What was correct is that whenever Alice is receiving something, so with using her state and the ciphertext, she will only update her state. And finally, when Bob is receiving something with his state and ciphertext, he will compute a key. So the sender algorithm and the receive algorithm for Alice, respectively Bob, will stay the same between bidirectional and sesquidirectional setting. But for the sesquidirectional setting, whenever Bob is sending something and Alice is receiving something, we don't have the functionality guarantee that any key is established between Alice and Bob. Okay, so let's summarize that a little bit. So C3 has the following properties. First of all, it has no functionality. But on the one hand, it can be used for efficiency. And it can be used for security. So we will see something in a couple of seconds. to be filled out in a couple of seconds when we look at the final unidirectional case. But before that, I just want to quickly say that there is a proof that if you take 2 times sesquidirectional ratchet key exchange and glue them together with a signature, this will give us a bidirectional ratchet key exchange scheme. And so we see already the first thing that we learn from simplifying things is that we do not have to look at the full bidirectional case, which is super complicated. Alice and Bob can send simultaneously. There are very complicated, interesting security guarantees that we will have to look at. And instead of looking at all of these things that are complicated, we can just look at the sesquidirectional case that is a little bit less complicated. Things do not overlap that much. There is no keys that are established from Bob to Alice. But the interesting part is we can just take these two things, glue them together, and we are happy. So we take one sesquidirectional ratchet key exchange for Alice, one for Bob. We put them together, and then we have a bidirectional ratchet key exchange for the two of them. Okay. So the final simplification that we do is we look at something that we call unidirectional ratcheted key exchange. So uni means one, and that basically means that only Alice is sending and Bob is only receiving. Okay. Again, we have just in the previous two cases, Alice and Bob. And the two of them will initialize their session with the init algorithm that establishes a state for Alice and a state for Bob. And now only Alice can send. Still, the idea is the same. She will establish keys. And whenever Bob is receiving the corresponding ciphertext, he will be able to compute the keys too. So this here is the simplest setting. And interestingly, what we can observe here is that Bob is purely deterministic. Because the two algorithms are now as follows. We still have the same init algorithm, but the send algorithm for state of Alice outputs an updated state of Alice, a key, and a ciphertext, and the receive algorithm for the state of Bob is deterministic, takes the state of, outputs a new state of Bob and an updated key, and it takes as input, of course, the ciphertext. Okay, now to just check how awake you are still and check how far the Zoom setting works, maybe a short time for you to think about what could on a high level be the difference between the unidirectional and the sesquidirectional setting with respect to security. So we've been leaving out this observation here that the ciphertext C3 that is sent from Bob to Alice can help Bob and Alice to get better or gain better security. And this ciphertext C3 is not part of the setting in the unidirectional case anymore because Bob cannot send anything. So I hope that your microphones work, or if your microphones don't work, please type something to the chat or whatever. Or whenever you think you don't come to the conclusion, please let me know. But I'm now waiting for a reaction, so just let me know what you think. Why is the Sescri directional setting offering stronger security, or why can it offer stronger security due to that ciphertext C3? Any idea? Maybe some sort of authentication? That's an interesting thought. But this is not the primary thing. So let's think a little bit more about confidentiality. Maybe think about a little bit about the ideas that we had for key encapsulation mechanisms and for key exchange, and that forward security is sometimes interesting and relevant. So, and that interaction sometimes helps us there. So maybe you have an idea based on that. Maybe to rephrase the question, what could be part of ciphertext C3? What could Bob put into the ciphertext C3 that is helpful? Any ideas? I guess C3 contains information how to choose the next key. Yeah. So maybe think in the sense of, so thanks for your contributions, and I'd be happy to continue this conversation via the chat. Maybe think about that also ratcheted key exchange is built from lower level building blocks. So as we've seen for in the lecture today, for authenticated public key encryption, Diffie-Hellman key exchange can be a building block. Authenticated encryption can be a building block. As we've seen for authenticated key exchange or interactive key exchange a couple of weeks ago, KEMS can be a building block, and so on. So we build our things together of building blocks. And what type of building block? And it's obviously a cryptographic building block if we want to achieve better security due to sending C3. So what kind of building block could help us here, or what type of cryptographic information could we send in C3? It's so just to make sure, and this might be a misunderstanding on my side, but if C3 only contains information on how to choose the next key in a administrative or organizational management type of manner, this will not really help us to get better security. It needs to be something that is cryptographic. Or put different, what type of goals could Bob achieve by sending something this with C3? Maybe to solve the question, Bob can sample fresh random values. To recover. From a corruption. This is the basic idea. So whenever Bob is corrupted, he can generate fresh information and share that information with other users. An idea could be Bob, when sending something, generates a fresh public key encryption scheme key pair or fresh chem key pair, and just sends the public key as part of C3 back to Alice. And then Alice can use that public key to encrypt something back to Bob. And so even if Bob was corrupted before sending something, Bob now has shared a fresh public key, knows a fresh secret key, and neither of those two information is known to the attacker because the corruption happened before that. And so this basically means that in the unidirectional case, Bob cannot contribute fresh values. And that basically means Bob cannot recover from corruptions. And we will see this a little bit more formal when we now start looking at unidirectional ratcheted key exchange in a more formal way. So first of all, let's think about the syntax. It was written down already, a unidirectional ratcheted key exchange is a tuple of three algorithms, init, send, and receive. And the init algorithm on no input probabilistically outputs two variables, state of Alice and state of Bob. The send algorithm on input of the state of Alice probabilistically outputs the fresh state of Alice, a key, and a ciphertext, and the receive algorithm on state of Bob, as well as a ciphertext, outputs deterministically a key. Okay, this is the syntax definition, the correctness definition. Is basically as follows. We want the following probability to hold for all cases, which basically means that the probability is one. And the probability is roughly as follows. We don't have too much time. I would like to interact with you, but due to the Zoom situation, it's even worse. But yeah, in 2 weeks, everything will be back to normal and we can talk about all those things. So what we basically want to have is that the key on the sender side with number I is the same key as on the receiver side with number I, with the following condition that, first of all, the first state of Alice and the first state of Bob are jointly computed with the init algorithm, then the next state of Alice and Bob I should stick with my notation here. So this is the sender state and this is the receiver state. And so the sender state S, the key S, and the ciphertext S are derived from the send algorithm on the previous state of the sender. And the ith state on the receiver and the ith key of the receiver are derived by using the receive algorithm on the previous state of the receiver and the current ciphertext that was sent by the sender. And we want this to hold true. Does that make sense? So basically, we want that whenever Alice is sending something and the ciphertext is given to Bob, then the key that was computed on Alice's side equals the key that is computed on Bob's side. Of course, Alice is continuously sending something, so we just want that, of course, the key that is sent in the ith step of Alice equals this key that is computed in the ith state of Bob. Okay, for security, we have a game. And we could also define correctness via a game. But today we just focus on the game that is used for security. And we call this game IND. For our scheme URKE, so unidirectional regulated key exchange, and it is parameterized by a bit B and executed with an adversary A. Okay, so we keep a couple of lines free to gradually understand what is going on here. Essentially, the first thing that really happens is that a sender state and a receiver state is computed jointly with the init algorithm. And then the adversary is executed. And the adversary outputs a bit B. And our game, as often, ends with that guess of the adversary being output to the upper environment. Okay, we have oracles, and as typical, we have oracles for an adversary to control the game. So the first algorithm that the attacker would like to control in this setting is an oracle for sending. And so this oracle we'll again have one blank line that we will fill in a second, and then it executes the send algorithm that outputs a key and a ciphertext as well as an updated state. And it takes as input the state of the sender before that. The primary challenge that we want to embed here is just as for key encapsulation mechanisms, for key exchange, for many things that we have seen before. So either the attacker is seeing a real key, which is K0, or a random key, which is K1. And this random key is indeed, as it has been done in many cases before, randomly sampled from the key space. Then we do some further bookkeeping and other things that we will talk about in a second. And then we return the challenge key as well as the ciphertext, which is what the attacker sees then. And finally, we have an oracle for controlling what the receiver does. And this oracle takes as input the ciphertext. At first, this oracle is executing the receive algorithm. And this outputs a state as well as a key on input of the state of the receiver and the ciphertext. Then there is a lot of bookkeeping that makes it interesting to think about this primitive. And eventually, we return the real key that was just computed. We will think about a lot of logic in a couple of seconds. But before this, we will look at two further oracles. So the main threat, the main problem that we are trying to encode here in this entire setting is that we have attackers, first of all, that just let's look back at this previous motivating graphic here. We have attackers who see everything. So all the traffic that is exchanged via the network is seen by the attacker, and we've modeled that already. So the send oracle will always output the ciphertext to the attacker, and the attacker can even be active. So the attacker can manipulate ciphertexts in transmission and change them before the receiver is receiving them. And so we have an active attacker, sees everything, can manipulate all the traffic. But the other thing that the attacker can do, and this was just modeled here on the left and on the right side, the attacker can corrupt the secret state of Alice and Bob. And this is what we have to model in our game as well. Just as we've done that with forward secure chems or interactive key exchange, where things can be corrupted. And we call this, since this is basically a state, we call this a little bit different. And so we call these oracles here oracle expose. And we have a particular expose oracle for the sender and a particular oracle for exposing the receiver. We will again do some bookkeeping, and the idea of the exposure is that the attacker receives the current state of the sender. We will also have to do a little bit more bookkeeping for exposures of the receiver state. But the core idea is that at the end, the attacker gets access to the receiver state. So this is on a very high level what we want to model. We want to model that it is hard for an attacker to obtain information on the keys that are exchanged between Alice and Bob via the send oracle and the receive oracle, even if the attacker sees the ciphertext, even if the attacker can manipulate the ciphertexts, and even if the attacker can, whenever possible, obtain the full state of the sender and the full state of the receiver. Those are the capabilities of the attacker and the goal of the attacker. The goal of the attacker is to guess the bit, the challenge bit B. Now, the final part is to model a little bit of what type of trivial attacks exist, what can happen, what might be bad, and so on and so forth. The first thing that we would like to model in order to have a language about what is going on is that we keep track of who's sending when and what. or basically what is sent and what is received. So we basically introduce two counters, a send counter that is initialized with zero, a receive counter that is initialized with zero, and a flag that says that at the beginning, Alice and Bob are communicating in sync. Okay, and now whenever Alice is sending something, she will eventually increment her send counter. And also, whenever the receiver is receiving something and everything worked out, the receiver will increment their receive counter. Now, interestingly, we have to trace in order to understand what means sync, what means out of sync, what can happen in order to make Alice and Bob out of sync. And so in order to do this, we will have to trace what is being sent, so what exactly is being sent and what is being received. Okay, and for this, we will basically add an array that we initialize for all entries with the bottom symbol. But whenever Alice is sending something, we will remind ourselves what has been sent. Okay. Now, what means in sync and what means out of sync? First of all, whenever something is received that does not match what has been sent, so basically, if the ciphertext that is received by Bob does not equal the ciphertext that was sent at the same time on Alice's side, then things can get out of sync. But of course, before that, things need to be in sync such that at that moment in time, things get out of sync. So if before that, everything was fine, but then a ciphertext is received on the receiver side that was not sent at the corresponding time on the sender side, then things get out of sync. So this is the first important part that we need to know. To understand when things can flip from in sync to out of sync. Okay, now the important, interesting part. What are the trivial attacks that we are facing here? And we will continuously, so there are, I think, four major trivial attacks that we have to cover, and we will continuously add and understand these trivial attacks. And I'm relying on you again. So what type of trivial attacks can you imagine? So what are the options that an attacker can perform all these things here in order to win the game without breaking anything that the construction is protecting, just against every construction, every possible construction, even the best ones? How far did we not yet limit the attacker enough such that attacks that are independent of constructions are still possible? Any ideas? maybe while we are doing this, I will quickly draw an image of what is going on here. So what the attacker can do is send or let the sender send something, let the receiver receive something, in particular, either the ciphertext that was sent by the sender or something that was just generated or forged by the attacker. What the attacker can do in addition to that is to corrupt the sender state between every two operations on the sender side, and the attacker can corrupt the receiver state between every two invocations of the receive algorithm via the receive oracle. Now, looking back at the game above, what can the attacker do to break this game, to win this game without any further effort?
Can the attacker expose the sender and then query the send oracle and compare the output with what he can compute on his own because he has the state of the sender?
Note that the send algorithm is probabilistic. So you could think of the send algorithm.
Yeah.
Just like a chem. So the sender state could contain a public key. And so the sender state does not reveal anything directly, but it's not too far away from what you've been saying. Note that the receiver is entirely deterministic.
Yeah, it could expose the receiver and query the receive oracle.
Yeah, that's an option, but so let's look again at where the challenge is output. And the idea of the attacker is to break the challenge, to win the challenge, to understand, to solve the challenge. And so maybe take a look at that. So maybe one thought, and we will add the first trivial attack that I want to mention in a second.
But just send and receive oracle? I mean,
this is the first thing. Yeah, exactly. Challenge on both sides. So this is the first thing. So what the attacker could do is query the send oracle. Get key in ciphertext. Query the receive oracle with the exact same ciphertext. Get back a key. And then finally, return or stop with key equals key k prime. This is the first issue that we have to solve. So the attacker sees the challenge key in the send oracle, and whenever things are received on the receiver side, we want that the receiver will not output information that trivially breaks the challenge. For that reason, we keep track of that, whether things are in sync or not. Okay, so this is the first thing that we will add here. So if sync equals one, return the bot symbol. Because the idea is that, of course, the receiver will compute the same key by correctness as the sender. And so if the sender was outputting the real key, then what is output on the receiver side is the same key. But if the sender is outputting the random key, because that's a challenge, that's when the challenge bit is one, in that case, we can compare the key that is computed on the receiver side with that random key and see that with high probability, one over the number of keys or of the size of the key space, those two keys are different. And for that reason, a key, an attacker can trivially break the scheme. We have another property that we model here. And this other property is that we also sample keys on the receiver side in case things become out of sync. Okay, so there are now three remaining trivial attacks. One of them was already closely explained, but not entirely. At least all of the remaining three attacks are using the ability to expose something. Any ideas?
Here we query the send oracle, expose the receiver, and then we can just compute the key on our own.
Yes, exactly. So we first query the send oracle that gives us key and a ciphertext. Then we query the expose receive oracle. This gives us the state of the receiver. And then we will compute what the receiver would be computing with the state of the receiver and the ciphertext that we were just getting. And we finally stop with k not equal k prime. Exactly. And for that reason, we have to make sure that the receive oracle is only permitted whenever there is no challenge that can be solved by that. Okay. So what we basically do now here is that we check whenever the expose oracle should be queried that if sync is still true and the sender has sent more than the receiver has received, then we will return bot, which means we do not give the attacker access to the receive oracle. And due to that, whenever there is still a challenge on the way that is meant for the receiver, and the receiver is still able to compute things because Alice and Bob, so sender and receiver, received and sent the same thing so far, then we will not give the attacker access to the state. Okay. There is an attack that is closely related to this. Not exactly the same, but almost the same. But this attack is not yet prevented by the measures that we implemented in the game so far. In order to perform this attack, the only thing that we have to change is one of the trivial attacks that we have already on the list, but we just have to change the order of execution, basically. Basically, receiver expose first and then send second. So first expose the receiver, obtain the state of the receiver, then let the sender send something, outputting a challenge key and the ciphertext. Then using the state of the receiver that we just saw before by invoking the receive algorithm with it, And finally, comparing the two keys, the challenge key and the actual key that the receiver was computing. And so for that reason, we will add a flag, a Boolean variable. And this Boolean variable tracks for the receiver if the receiver was exposed already. At the beginning, it is set to 0. And once the exposed oracle is queried, the receiver is still in sync. And sender and receiver have the same amount of sent and received information. In that case, we set that Boolean flag to 1. And now the condition that needs to hold in the sent oracle is that if this Boolean flag is set to 1, then we do not allow that the oracle is queried. And for that reason, we immediately return nothing. Since I have the feeling that this is already a little bit of complicated information that you have to digest until the next lecture, I will wait for the final trivial attack that is called sender impersonation. Until next week. And we quickly review what we've been doing until so far. So the first thing that we did today was understanding again what the role of ratcheted key exchange in secure messaging is. So the role of ratcheted key exchange is that it continuously computes the keys of the senders and receivers that are used for encryption of the messages. So basically produces symmetric keys that are used with a secure channel to encrypt the payload. But more importantly, it updates the secret state of the sender and of the receiver, such that whenever the state is corrupted, we want that previous symmetric keys that are used for encryption stay secure, and also future keys stay secure. The basic idea is that whenever I have secret information on my channel that I would like to have never been leaked to an attacker, I can delete the message on my phone, and the ciphertext that is on the channel that is being observed by the attacker, and also the state that might be corrupted in the past or might be corrupted in the future, those information will never leak enough information together with the ciphertext about the message that I have been just sending to my communication partner. This is the idea on a super high level. We break this idea down into three notions of ratcheted key exchange, and all of them should offer forward security and post-compromise security. Forward security, as we've been talking about this a couple of weeks already about chems and interactive key exchange, this means that whenever I am corrupted, my previous conversations stay secure. And post-compromise security means that my communication right now will be secure even if previously I was corrupted. So we can basically draw a line. That means that in the middle, something bad happens, and still we achieve security. Forward security means everything in the past is secure. Post-compromise security means everything in the future will be secure. This is the idea, and we can compose this, of course, multiple times. So even if there are multiple corruptions on either of the two sides of the conversation, then still only those small fractions of the conversation should be affected by that. The first notion of ratcheted key exchange that we look at was bidirectional ratcheted key exchange. Bidirectional ratcheted key exchange means that sender and receiver can both send and receive. And so both of them can establish new keys. This is what typically double ratchet messaging channels achieve and can do. But it's not necessary to look at that full notion because SES bidirectional ratcheted key exchange already offers everything that we need with a little bit less complexity. And the less complexity is that ciphertext sent from the receiver back to the sender will not offer any functionality, but they will contribute to security. In particular, they will help Bob to recover from a previous corruption, which means post-compromise security is enabled due to the conversation or the ciphertext sent from Bob to Alice. Of course, Alice will always be able to recover because she can always send. So there is a formal result in a paper called Asynchronous Ratcheted Key Exchange that I've been mentioning 2 weeks ago. And this result shows that two times using SES bidirectional ratcheted key exchange, one in each of the directions being put together, offer us full bidirectional ratcheted key exchange. Now, for simplicity and to get an idea of what is being done, we will focus throughout most of the lecture on unidirectional ratcheted key exchange because we want to understand formally what is going on there. What are the security guarantees? How can we build that thing? This is the simplest notion. It only allows Alice to send and it only allows Bob to respond, but neither of them ever switch roles. So they will always be the sender and they will always be the receiver. The syntax is super easy. We have three algorithms, init, send, and receive. Init outputs the state for Alice and Bob. Send takes the state of Alice, updates the state of Alice, outputs a key and a ciphertext. Key is used for outside protocols like authenticated encryption. And the ciphertext is given to Bob, who can, with his own state, update his own state to the next level and compute the key that was computed on the other side. Correctness means, in that setting, that keys computed on Alice's side and on Bob's side should be the same for each iteration of send and receive invocations. And with security, we are still trying to figure out what it really means, and we will fully fulfill everything in the next iteration. The basic capabilities that the attacker has to break security are that the attacker can choose whenever Alice is sending something, choose whatever Bob is receiving thereafter. So either the real ciphertexts or ciphertext that the adversary chooses. In addition to that, in order to model what corruptions are, the attacker can always expose the sender and always expose the receiver up to certain limits. And we are currently in the process of understanding when these limits occur. The first limitation that we wanted to have is that, of course, when the send oracle outputs challenge keys, then the keys that are computed on the receiver side should not break these challenges directly. And so as long as sender and receiver are synchronously communicating, the keys that are computed on Bob's side are necessarily the same by correctness as on the sender side. And for that reason, as long as Bob is in sync, Bob will never output any key to the attacker. The second trivial attack that we've seen is that, of course, if the sender is outputting something, but the receiver did not receive it yet, then the receiver can still receive it. And so taking the exposure oracle to obtain the state that is capable of receiving that key just gives us enough information to invoke and execute the receive algorithm ourselves. And so first querying the send oracle, then getting the corresponding state on the receiver side, and then just executing the receive algorithm will give us enough information to compute the key. This is the second trivial attack that we just prevented by making sure that whenever the receiver is still in sync and there are ciphertexts that the receiver has not received yet, Then, of course, the state of the receiver suffices to compute the keys that are established by these ciphertexts. So in those cases, we forbid that the receiver can be corrupted or exposed. And finally, one can invert this attack by just first exposing the receiver state and then letting the sender send something. And then again, we have enough information to just execute the receive algorithm and compute the right key. And for that reason, we implemented a measure in which whenever the expose oracle of the receiver is invoked, and the receiver is still in sync, and the receiver has received the same information or the same ciphertext that the sender already sent, then we mark the receiver exposed. And so whenever the send oracle is invoked after that, we will not output any challenge after that. So basically, we will just silence the send oracle after that, because otherwise challenges that are computed and output by the send oracle are trivially computable by the attacker. There is a fourth attack that we did not cover yet, which is called sender impersonation. And sender impersonation has something to do with authenticity. So maybe one of you is smart enough to explain that attack in 2 minutes, or we will just end here and we will talk about all of this in 2 weeks. The basic requirement on your side now for the next 2 weeks is get a feeling for what is going on here. And next week to watch videos from previous conferences of the IACR, like videos from previous crypto conferences or previous Eurocrypt conferences or AsiaCrypt conferences or real world crypto conferences. Just look at the website of the IACR. I've been linking that online. There is the YouTube channel of the IACR, and you can just browse through it, look for interesting talks, interesting titles, maybe also look at the papers, get an idea of what is going on in the paper, and please at least watch 2 videos and look at the corresponding 2 papers, and we will discuss about the videos and the papers that you've been looking at in 2 weeks. Are there any questions? If not, then I will just stop the recording here. And I thank you very much for your attention. See you in 2 weeks again. And thanks.